Okay, this is David Klein on June the 8th in Louisville, Kentucky, and for the Southern Oral History Program's Long Civil Rights Movement Project. And if you could just introduce yourself for the tape.
My name is Tim Barry. I'm the director of the Louisville Metro Housing Authority.
And I've been here talking with people about the Park Duval neighborhood and basically social issues and social justice issues over time. Clearly housing is one of those. And if you could just tell me a little bit about how you came to learn about that area and the approaches that you've taken with public housing in the Park Duval neighborhood.
Yeah, I'll probably start with, you know, and this is not a revelation to you, but as a backdrop, you know, Louisville has been a highly segregated town and still is to this day. I mean, when people in Louisville refer to the South End, West End, and East End. And with that comes certain perceptions, connotations, you know, that none of which are accurate, but, you know, nevertheless, it's a highly segregated town. And, you know, I came to know about Park Duval because when I became director of the Housing Authority, well, actually precedes that, I worked for city government, and this is still kind of sort of part of city government, for close to 30 years, worked for this mayor in the mayor's office for 13 years, and I was working on a project to expand our airport and move a bunch of people, and that was winding down, and the mayor was very much involved when Clinton was president in getting a Hope 6 grant, the first one of the first ones in the country, to redevelop a public housing site that was called Cotter and Lang. And he asked me to kind of oversee that from his office to make sure that it got done. So that's how I got involved with the Housing Authority.
Okay.
And then when Jerry Abramson left as mayor of the old city, the new fellow that came in, David Armstrong, who's a grand guy too, asked me to stay. So I stayed in the mayor's office for a couple of years. But then when the former director here retired, Mayor Armstrong asked if I wanted to do the job, and the reason was because I already had some connections here, contact and understanding, but only from a Park Duval perspective. So that's how I ended up at the Housing Authority. But talking about Park Duval, I think what you know, the opportunity that things like Hope 6 have given us, and it's certainly not perfect, but it's a vehicle to deal with some of the concentration of poverty that these large public housing complexes represent. And also create just plain old better housing for people who don't make a lot of money, and that's the bad, that's the beauty of Hope 6, because for the first time, the federal government through the Department of Housing and Urban Development allowed us to take public housing money, and create something other than just public housing units, and to use that money to leverage private funds, which we have done very well, to create a mixed income, mixed use neighborhood. And that's the linchpin of Park Duval. That's the linchpin of any successful Hope 6 project, is the fact that what you are doing is replacing, you know, a large, outdated public housing facility where you warehouse people. And in our case, and I'm sure this holds true in many other places in the country, you've got an aging facility that's six decades old, where the, you know, things are just wearing out, and it needs to be replaced. Has nothing to do with the residents. Has everything to do with the age of the structure. You know, it's a 60-year-old house. If you don't make major changes in 60 years, your house is going to fall apart at the seams. You know, and I've also come to believe, and I think we have learned, that that's no way to house people. That I think that kind of housing, not only is a form of segregated housing, not necessarily by design, maybe so, but by default, it's segregated housing. I think it stigmatizes people in a horrible way.
Right.
And I think it disenfranchises them and make them feel like second-class citizens.
Excludes them.
Absolutely. For one thing and one thing only, money. It's all about money. And it's about race, too, but it's also about money. If they made more money, they wouldn't be there. So the object of Hope 6 is to make, you know, to recreate the neighborhood so that it is mixed use, mixed income, while still giving many of the former residents of that site the opportunity to live in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that not everybody could come back. Not everybody wanted to come back. But the fact that in Park Duval, we have created a mixed income community where a third of the apartments are earmarked for low-income families, most of whom are, you know, public housing residents, is a good thing, because then, and they're not units that are situated in one place.
Right.
So they float.
Right.
So.
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting concept. So you don't have, well, all the public housing units are over here. They float. We have a percentage that we try to adhere to. So a third of the units are set aside for low-income families, very low-income, people that would qualify for public housing. A third are generally for middle-income families.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that's just supported with tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
And a third are for market rate. There's nothing magic about the formula. Other cities have used different percentages, but, you know, if it ain't broke.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to stay on those percentages, units will float. The unit over here today may be a public housing unit, but tomorrow it could very well be occupied by a market rate person. But the unit over here could switch as well. So we always have that percentage, but it's all.
I hadn't realized that. That's interesting.
Yeah,
right.
That's beautiful.
Right.
Because you never know.
Right.
If the tenant's a public housing unit or paying $100 a month in rent. I don't know. Nor should I. It's none of my damn business.
And there are private homes that have been developed along in the area as well, right?
And others, you know, we've had, you know, homes where the families living in those homes, income may range from $30,000 to $35,000 a year, all the way to $300,000. And they all fit very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the homes that are built are not segregated by income. There's some segregation just by size, because some people have bigger houses than others. And, you know, we don't have any problems. Some of the problems that existed at Cotter and Lang, the public housing site, just aren't there anymore.
And what problems were those?
Well, drugs and guns. We still have some, especially of late, the last couple of days, we've had some problems with the whole gun thing. But, you know, like large public housing complexes, it attracts the predators who come in to buy and sell drugs. That doesn't mean to say that everybody public housing, is. I mean, there are people in public housing, obviously, who are doing things they ought not be doing. But our biggest problem, bar none, are the people that come in who don't live there. Not on the lease, have no business being there to buy and sell drugs. And they're attracted by the concentration of poverty and other things. So if you scatter that a little bit, the market's not there.
Right.
So we just don't have, but for the recent shooting in that area, we just don't have any problems. And which I think speaks to the issue of the type of housing that creates the problem in the environment and not the residents.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we still have, let me think, over 250 families at Park Duval today who are former Cotter Lang residents or public housing residents. We don't have any problems. We don't have any of the crime we used to have. So that tells me, and rightfully so, because it's true, it's not the residents. It's the type of housing. When you send a clear message when you warehouse people like that, they are second-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And by changing that environment, you know, we have given people an opportunity to have good, safe, quality, affordable housing in a safe neighborhood, which then means at least that issue's addressed so that they can go on and do other things, including, you know, get the training, education they need and find jobs and all that. Is, you know, for the most part, it's working pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So what makes a neighborhood? I mean, this is one thing that we were talking about, was various programs that sort of really fill out a community, such as the Boy Scouts. You were talking about the new choir.
Yep.
Can you tell me about these programs?
We have a number of programs that have been offered to public housing residents, from getting their high school equivalency GED, to computer training. We have an escrow account that we've set up for residents, that for every dollar they put in, it's a savings account, we match it with $2. And people have accumulated some wealth.
So that they can achieve their own home ownership at some point.
And that's what they do. And they've been sitting there very quietly, you know, stashing money away, and they'll roll out of here with some bucks. You know, when the one we just did, we had a gentleman had $30,000. He walked out and said, "I don't need you. See ya. We'll buy a house." Good for him, you know. And that. So we've offered a whole array of programs to help residents get where they want to go. Not everybody needs help. Mm-hmm. Not everybody needs help. You know, the thing you have to remember, at least about, and I can only speak for our public housing, but I think it holds true for most cities, is that, number one, our biggest problem, bar none, are the people that come in from the outside. Don't belong there. Don't. If they would go away, wouldn't have some of the problems I have now. And we have a 25% turnover rate a year. So in 4 years, every unit has turned. So this misconception about people living in public housing forever is wrong. Yeah, we have some people been there for 30 years. It's terribly wrong because most people in public housing stay about two and a half years.
Was that true for Cotter and Lang as well?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So this is just a misconception.
Oh, horrible misconception that people just stay there and never leave. That's bull. I mean, they do leave. Well, a lot of them go on to, you know, they only need public housing for a bit to get back on their feet, which was it was designed for that purpose.
Right.
So just to suggest that it has failed completely is wrong. It hasn't. I mean, people have taken advantage of it. A lot of what we see are single women with small children whose relationship, marriage didn't work out. So, you know, it's no longer a two-income family.
Right.
They need some assistance for a while. They get back on their feet and they're gone in 2 years. You know, they're out, got, you know, better job, paying market rate someplace. See you later. And that's the way it's supposed to work.
Right.
So, and yes, we do have some people that stay for a while, but most of them now are senior citizens who have been there a long time. They're very accustomed to the neighborhood, and that's where they want to live, and fine.
Right.
They should be able to do that.
And there is senior housing as part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Park Duval has.
I was in that the other day.
Senior-only building.
Yeah.
And which, you know, as the population, as us boomers age, you know, you're going to see more and more need for that.
Right.
But, you know, Park Duval has been a good experiment that has panned out well for us. It hasn't done well in every city. I happen to think it's because it's the city's fault.
The Hope 6 projects?
Yeah. I mean, they haven't done a very good job getting them off the ground. Just having the diversity of use, both rental and home ownership, and the diversity of incomes, it is, you know, it's not rocket science. If you look around and see, and I can only speak for little old Louisville, Kentucky, and you look at the neighborhoods that have, you know, not have thrived, but also are still with us, still here, still, you know, doing their thing. Our neighborhoods, like Old Louisville, like Beachmont, like, you know, the Highlands, they are mixed use, been income, and have been from the get-go. There's businesses there. There's all different incomes. There's apartments. There's homes. And they continue to just hum right along.
Right.
And so it's not, we're not inventing things here. We're just kind of looking around thinking, well, you know, this kind of works.
Right.
And there's a lot of little subtle things we do, particularly from a design standpoint, that's very important.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Park Duval is a new urbanist project, and as is the new one, Liberty Green. And basically, you know, the new urbanist approach tries to capture things that were created 100 years ago in other neighborhoods that seem to have worked well. Not the least of which is, you know, something that it's like a big duh when you hear it, but it didn't dawn on me until I heard it, that there's a huge emphasis on the front of the house. You know, in suburbia, everybody goes to their backyard and does their thing, and there's very little interaction. Not in places like Park Duval and other urban neighborhoods where the emphasis is on the front of the house. You have sidewalks, which encourages people to walk, which doesn't bring in crime. What it does is give you a set of eyes watching out what's going on. Front porches. You go to Park Duval big time. People sitting on the front porch, which means they're watching things, which means they're talking to their neighbors, getting to know one another. And that's one of the families, I think, of suburbia, where everybody goes to their backyard and hides on their deck. And that, you know, that's a design thing that's very, very important. Which
very interesting.
And that's a, you know, that's a new urbanist principle. You see some magnificent porches. Because if you think about it, that's what people used to do, mm-hmm. sit on their porch and commiserate with their neighbors. And right. therefore, you know, anybody who wanted to come into the neighborhood and do bad things, you got a whole bunch of eyes watching you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the, you know, mixed income, mixed use approach, not although not perfect, nothing is, you know, works pretty well. We've put it to good use, and it's sad. And I'm just really, really disappointed and sad to see that the money has been cut for this program.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll leave the politics out of it.
Have you, have there been parts of the Parc des Vaux experience that didn't maybe work out quite as well that you can use as lessons for Liberty Green?
Mm-hmm. First thing is to get in a grocery store. Mm-hmm. We're struggling to get a grocery store, trying to get a grocery store in there. And if we got a grocery store in there, that would cinch the deal. But it's hard because, for a couple of reasons, you know, the grocery business in Louisville is not real competitive. It's a Kroger town.
Mm-hmm.
Kroger runs everybody else off. So eventually they may build in Parc des Vaux one day, but there's no pressure to build. I can't do any leverage with them. And the other thing is just the perception of, you know, predominantly African-American inner-city neighborhood that, you know, it's we're not going to do business. You know all the crap. None of it true. But if we could just get somebody to go in there,
right?
Oh, I think they would do a bang-up business because of the loyalty issue. People in Parc des Vaux are now, when they go on to go to the grocery store, jump the bridge and go to Southern Indiana or have to travel miles to get groceries. When that's the one thing. And it's not for lack of effort because the mayor has just worked diligently to try to get somebody to build it, you know, a decent grocery store too. So,
right.
That won't be a problem at Liberty Green, I don't think, because it's a different environment. Parc des Vaux is almost a suburb, whereas Liberty Green is smack dab in the middle of downtown.
So. Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, but there may not be, you know, we're not going to have a super Kroger or a big old Walmart Meijer thing in the middle of downtown, but we'll have some kind of food service that'll pop up.
Other lessons learned?
Other than that, the one thing the Housing Authority didn't do that we are now doing with Liberty Green is, and I'm not blaming anybody, you know, you live and learn, is a thing called one-for-one replacement. We lost, you know, there were 1,300 units at Cotter and Lang, all of which were demolished. What came out of the ground at Parc des Vaux is roughly 1,100 units, but only, all told, including the, you know, the home ownership, but there's only 250 or so units set aside for low-income families. So mm-hmm. there's been a net loss of affordable housing. I happen to think, as the Housing Authority, that's probably not a good thing for a Housing Authority to be doing, to be responsible for a net loss of affordable housing. We're in the business of providing affordable housing. So we took a different approach with our new Hope 6 and have committed to doing one-for-one replacement of every unit lost, hard units. Not going to count Section 8 vouchers or any of that stuff. I mean, actual hard unit. So that we won't be responsible for net loss of affordable housing. And I don't know anybody else in the country who's doing it. It's not, mm-hmm. it used to be required by HUD. It's not anymore. We chose to. It's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're going to do it. And we're also on a mission to replace every one of our large public housing complexes in concert with the mayor. This is one of the mayor's initiatives, is to replace all these complexes, because there's still some left, and replace them with scattered sites.
So I guess that leads me right to my next question, which was, you know, what's the future?
To get rid of all these complexes again. Let me emphasize, underscore, has nothing to do with the residents, absolutely nothing to do with the residents. It's a housing type that's outlived its usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't provide for any kind of quality of life for families, green space for kids, you know, all the things I've mentioned. It's segregated housing. It really, 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 I think, stigmatizes people, makes them feel like second-class citizens. Scattered site, on the other hand, same family, and it's all about money. It's only for money. It's only because of money. Scattered site means that we have an individual unit someplace in a neighborhood all over town, or units scattered, you know, hither and yon, very quietly, mm-hmm. that people move in, we'll get assistance from us, a subsidy. We own the units, but
it's
not a concentration.
Right.
So they've just become part of the fabric of the neighborhood.
Right.
And people may know that it's a public housing unit. They may not. What we have made an effort to do and are very strident about it is that our scattered site units will be at least as good as everything else on that block, and most of the time better kept, much better kept. Because the first time they're not, you know how that goes. Oh,
right.
It's a public housing unit, all hell, you know, the world's coming to an end. And so we're on a mission, and just personally, I hate those places, those large public housing complexes, because of what they do to people. Get them out of that environment, into a scattered site, or they get a voucher and won't go wherever they want. You know, it levels the playing surface. It gets rid of that stigma associated with where they live, which keeps them from, in many cases, and I know for a fact it does, getting jobs. Because if a potential employer finds out they live in a public housing complex, they, you know, they're real leery.
Right.
Because they assume
that
they're
stigma.
Into drugs and guns, you know,
right.
And they're not. But then you get them out of that environment and put them someplace else. Then, you know, that issue's addressed in terms of housing. And so we're, you know, moving very quickly, like
that,
a lot of cities.
In that direction. And how is that, how will that be funded?
Well, we'll have to pay for it with our, you know, normal stream of federal funding,
right.
Which is going down. But we're going to have to figure, and we're going to do one for replacement, every one of these units. So it's expensive and it's hard. And, you know, we're not always well received when we go into a neighborhood if they find out we're buying units. But, you know, I'm also not going to reconcentrate the poverty that existed. We're very, very judicious about what we do. In terms of buying a few units at a time.
Right.
One of the things we've been able to do is buy into developments where there's, let's say there's an apartment complex, we got 250 units that's undergoing a rehab, new owners, that kind of stuff. We'll buy 10 units.
Right.
Which is, you know, 10 units, give me a break.
Right.
You know.
Otherwise, the difficulty, the political difficulty of buying into existing neighborhoods.
Yeah, it'll throw you just when I think the worst, you know, and that people just, you know, are just stupid. I'll get a neighborhood and say, yeah, it's okay, no problem. We don't, in a neighborhood that I wouldn't think would say that, would say, you know, we need to provide more affordable housing. We need to open up our arms and welcome people of, you know, even different races, but also lower incomes. I thought, oh my God. You know, so I, you know, my belief in the goodness of human beings, basically, you know, it's re-energized because of things like that. Then you'll run into a situation where you expect better of people,
right?
And then they'll, you know, all their fears will come up.
This idea of scattered site housing and not concentrating poverty and moving it out into different communities, it seems like a lesson. Hard earned and took a long time to learn.
Yeah, I think it
in this country.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a race issue.
Yeah,
more than anything, because most public housing is, you know, dominated by African Americans. So it's clearly a race issue, and it's also an economics issue. But I really firmly believe that these large public housing complexes are a breeding ground for crime, predators, and also a real impediment to people succeeding. Because not only do they oftentimes have to live in fear of what's going on around them, but it makes them feel like second-class citizens. Get them out of that environment, and they don't live in a place where there's gunplay and drugs all that much, and then you know, then they can go on and do some other stuff that they've been trying to do. And I don't like the way it's been set up. And, don't get me wrong, it served a very useful purpose for many, many years. But, you know, it's outlived its usefulness, time to chuck it and do something better. And I think scattered site is a much better approach. So.
Right.
That's my 2 cents worth.
Great. Anything that you want to add, or maybe a question I didn't ask that would have been a useful question to
No, the only thing is that, you know, I get discouraged sometimes because that's, you know, that's the patterns of segregation in this community that are 200 years old are still there and really, really hard to right the ship, you know, to turn it. But it's like turning a battleship. It takes a while. But ever so slowly, you know, I see more and more census tracts in what was predominantly lily white areas becoming much more diverse. And that's very good. Now, what we can't leave behind are the people that, for whatever reason, don't have the income, you know, to support that kind of stuff. And that's why I think it's important that we also diversify those neighborhoods with some affordable housing. that is real hard to do,
mm-hmm.
to make it a requirement. We've tried in Louisville and it hadn't worked so far to require developers to create a certain number of affordable housing units, but oh man, that's a red flag for people. Because what they think is poor people, public housing, predominantly African Americans, you know the drill. And that's not the case, and very few countries, very few cities in this country have been able to do it, mm-hmm. but for one place in Maryland. We have required every new
where it's building. Actually on the books.
Yeah, they ran out of land. Yeah, and it's on the books that they have to create a certain amount of affordable housing units, which I think is a stroke of genius. But, you know, it's I like, and I have to believe this, there's no point keep doing this, is that, you know, it's moving the right way. You know, people are getting some wealth and are able to live in other parts of the community, and we just can't leave the very poor behind.
Right. Thank you very much.
Glad to do it, Dave.
Thank you.